Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do young people get from playing sports? Lots of American parents who encourage their sons and daughters to play are pleased to see their kids learning discipline and cooperation, getting good exercise, and gaining confidence in themselves. My guest today imagined many of the same benefits would come to a soccer team she organized in 2004, except recruiting players was vastly more complicated than just signing up with a local league. The young athletes were from Afghanistan. They had never been allowed to even practice in public there, much less travel halfway across the world to compete. They were poor, and they were girls. Awista Ayoub founded the Afghan Youth Sports Exchange in 2003. Her new book about the experience is called However Tall the Mountain, A Dream, Eight Girls, and a Journey Home. Awista, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
We should start with your own background. You were born in Afghanistan in 1979, but your family moved to Connecticut just a couple of years later. What did it take for them to get out?
It was a very complicated journey. I think in the late 70s, certainly, there was so much violence that overtook the country. And my own father, which I write about in the book, was working for the government. So he wasn't a communist supporter at the time. So he actually was one of many Afghans who were actually targeted because they weren't supporting the regime. And so for us, he fled alone to go to Pakistan, where the U.S. embassy there was open and actually granting visas. And then my mother and my two young siblings and I, and then an aunt and I, we all traveled overnight and crossed the border, which is very dangerous at the time with landmines that were spread out around the land and then just helicopters overhead. So it was a very difficult journey. I was only two at the time and have no memories of that moment, but certainly in the stories my mother told me over the years, I'm not only very appreciative of her taking that risk, but I've certainly benefited from my life here in the States and really felt the need to give back after that.
Yeah, she essentially got you smuggled out in like a farming truck.
She did, mm-hmm. And it was overnight so that the borders were a little bit more loose. They weren't as watched as strictly during the evening hours, but the issues of landmines and then just bombings overhead were the main concerns.
Now, for a long time, your parents sincerely hoped that they might be able to return and sort of resume their lives there. How did that affect the way that you learned to view your dual culture as this American kid being raised in an Afghan home?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was very, for me, a unique experience. I think at times I was too American to fit in with the Afghan community and too Afghan to fit into the American community. And what's interesting is in the 80s, very few people really even heard of Afghanistan. So when I was in school, to say that I was Afghan, really, you know, students looked at me with a blank stare, which is very different today from a lot of the media images that the young kids and adults might have of the country. But it was a very unique experience in that I had a very Americanized life outside of the home, but then a very Afghan life inside. And my parents were very good about teaching us the language and the culture. And like I said in the book, there was this hope that we would go back and it would be a temporary removal from the country and a temporary stay in the States, and that just never materialized. So I think year by year, they lost that hope, but the culture was still strong in our home.
I think what's really interesting, Awista, is that now if you walked into a classroom and said you were Afghan, people would know what you meant. But the vision that people who don't have direct ties to the country is that Afghanistan is a place of war and poverty and repression. Will you talk for a minute about the Afghanistan that your parents described for you as it was before the late 70s?
Sure. I think in the late 70s, up to that point, and in the mid-60s, women's rights was definitely at the forefront of the government, and provisions were made in the Constitution to address those issues. And so women were, particularly in the larger cities in Kabul and in Kandahar, were very progressive. In particular, in Kabul, women were working outside of the home in large numbers. You saw women wearing bell-bottoms and miniskirts that were just hanging out in Kabul by the poolside and hanging out socially. And so for me, images of my mother were always very open and progressive. And if you showed me a picture of a woman in America in the 1970s and then an Afghan woman, my own mother in particular, I wouldn't be able to tell you the difference. And that's how similar the cultures were and how progressive the culture was at the time, which certainly isn't the case today. And I think it's even harder when you have these rights and opportunities that are suddenly taken away from you.
Yeah, and your parents were and are progressive, but in fact are practicing Muslims and very proud of their faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They are.
Your mom, in fact, had played on a basketball team in high school.
She did. And what's interesting is women's sports was in existence in the 70s as well, but women migrated more towards volleyball and basketball as the two main sports, and soccer was more predominantly male, which is something I didn't really come to understand later on, until later. But yeah, she played sports, my father as well. So it was a very progressive country in many regards.
So when you were growing up, how did you envision that you might return to the place where you were born, if not to move there, even just to sort of go there?
I think it's hard when I was younger to remember. I just always had heard stories of my father and my mother growing up. And there was, of course, I think like many first-generation immigrants who leave their homeland and are pretty much not able to go back. There's this desire of always wanting to relive your life and your childhood back there. And my dad would tell us wonderful stories, and my mother would tell us wonderful stories of the country. And I always try to picture myself in those stories, and it was something that I could do in my own head, but not in reality. And it really wasn't until after 9/11 that the country opened up again, and the Taliban left Afghanistan from power in October of 2001, that I really started to think that it could become a reality.
Awista Ayoub is my guest. She's the founder of the Afghan Youth Sports Exchange. Her new book is called However Tall the Mountain, A Dream, Eight Girls, and a Journey Home. One thing that you knew, even after the post 9/11 invasion sort of made this possible, you knew that you didn't want to go back just as a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I've always been very involved with organizations and having my hands in the mix versus just being an observer and an outsider. And I actually started the women's ice hockey team at my university, the University of Rochester, when I was an undergraduate degree. And so for me, very much, I knew that I wouldn't be content just going and looking and taking pictures and being a tourist and coming back. And it was really how can I make a difference in the short time that I might be there and do it in a way that's effective?
And you alluded to the fact that you weren't aware until later that soccer was really a boys' game historically in Afghanistan. But in fact, you didn't ever actually play soccer.
No, I played tennis in high school and then played ice hockey, like I said, in college. But picking soccer for me was very much, to some degree, an American mindset. You know, I grew up in the States with Title IX being at the forefront for the rights of women in sports, and also seeing the American women's national team succeeding on a very global level and being champions of the World Cup and also the Olympics. So I'd always envisioned soccer as being a gender-neutral sport and that you would have just as much women playing as men. And it really wasn't until after the girls went back that I came to realize that when I was recruiting, it was difficult to find girls, not because the sports infrastructure was destroyed, which is what I assumed, but rather that women just didn't play soccer. Certainly soccer was an easy sport also for the girls to take back. And so my thinking and rationale was that it would be acceptable for girls to play, but also it would be easy for them to just have a ball and get a group of kids to play alongside them.
Yeah, there's not a lot of equipment startup in order to get teams going.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you were educated at the time and, as you mentioned, very involved in a lot of organizations. But I wonder if you can talk for a minute about what it takes at age 23 to start a nonprofit from the ground up.
Sure. I mean, it took a lot of research. My undergraduate degree was in chemistry, which is, you know, interesting in itself. And what it has taught me is very much that the legwork that you do even before you get into a lab and use it as an analogy with a project before you start a project very much can make or break the success of it. And so I did a lot of research just on what it would take to start an organization. And I also saw that no one else was doing the work that I wanted to do, which was to work with youth in Afghanistan through sports. And so it was a very easy extension of who I was. But then also I found organizations both in the States and then an organization in Kabul who would work with me and really help me to recruit the girls, but also allow me to fundraise and use their 501c3. So that made it very easy, and that was through research that I saw that could be an option. I think, you know, at 23 at times, people always say that we're, you know, when you're younger, sometimes you're the most bold and you're not afraid of failure and you just move forward. And so I would say that that's very much how I viewed the work at the time. I was just so passionate about it and knew that I couldn't fail as long as I had that motivation. And really was a bit audacious in doing what I did. And certainly it's turned out pretty well, but there's no way at the time that I knew, you know, where the program would take me and the girls 5 years later.
Yeah, talk for a minute about your vision for what this would be and the form that it would take when you were setting all this up.
Sure. I'm very much in the mindset of helping to build the local capacity. And so for me, bringing the girls here was a way to provide them top-level training in the hopes that when they went back that they would hopefully start programs locally, whether with boys or with girls, and just helping to teach more kids about the sport. And so with that, the one reason why I picked soccer was for that reason. But eventually what came to happen was that the girls did have struggles initially upon their return home, but certainly overcame them together as a team, and did really help to start this movement of girls soccer locally in Kabul, which has also expanded in some of the cities outside of Kabul as well.
Yeah, you write about the surreal experience of becoming overnight almost a 20-something soccer mom to these girls that you brought over.
Exactly. I even had my mom's van that summer that I drove around.
So they were going to be here for 6 weeks and sort of travel while they practiced.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. And they were also being tested by playing games at various points within the 6 weeks. And at the end, we're to compete in an international children's game tournament in Cleveland as the Afghan national team, this kind of makeshift team. But it was really challenging and interesting to see for them and for me, you know, these benchmarks along the road that really made them go outside of their own comfort zone, and me as well, and seeing what really the importance of teamwork and being on playing sports means for these girls. And I know in the beginning they handled the losses pretty hard, but eventually, and you see in the book, from game to game, they really start to form a stronger energy as a team and really overcome these obstacles with a lot more poise as well.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because we see that at first they would seem to have a lot in common, but they don't really operate as a team right away.
They don't, and that was a shock to me as well. You know, I think, again, I grew up here in the States playing organized sports, and you take that for granted, and you assume that globally also that other youth have also had that experience. And by the time they're 12, 13, 14, they're so used to winning and losing on the playing field and know how to handle those struggles. But when these girls came, they really had never had a chance to really live out their lives on a playing field. And by default, very much handled these losses really poorly. But coupled with that was these were girls from a war zone, the post-conflict zone. And really the only way they saw disputes handled locally was through violence. And that was very much the way that they initially would handle arguments and situations that might have come up on the playing field, was through arguing and talking even louder and yelling versus calmly and rationally working through these issues. And so that was something interesting for me and for them that really I had to work towards changing in the 6 weeks that they were here. And I would certainly say that when they went back after the 6 weeks that I think it did get through to them. And in the book, again, you see them coming to a head locally as well, very much in terms of how they handle conflict and issues.
You think initially that it was a sort of survival instinct that they would fight before they would cooperate?
Sure, without a doubt, without a doubt. And especially in your own community, if that's the only way you see adults handling issues, it's very normal and very comfortable for you to fall into that same trap as well. So certainly, I think, again, they've overcome it by a large degree today.
Awista Ayoub is my guest. She's founder of the Afghan Youth Sports Exchange. Her new book is called However Tall the Mountain, A Dream, Eight Girls, and a Journey Home. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can get to us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founder of the Afghan Youth Sports Exchange, Awista Ayoub. Her new book is called However Tall the Mountain, A Dream, Eight Girls, and a Journey Home. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. For people, I don't think people need to be reminded that the time in which these girls were not even coming of age, but sort of even learning to understand the world outside their own homes, was the height of the Taliban's hold on the people of Afghanistan. Can you talk about sort of the way they understood this and the way that their lives were limited during those years?
Sure. Many of the girls were fairly young, and so some of the edicts that the Taliban had issued at the time didn't affect them per se personally, but it did affect their families, and to some degree did in other ways affect them. The girls, for many of them, weren't able to go to school, as girls' schools were closed throughout the country. And so you see in the book as well that their lives are really at home and are limited to the area that might just be surrounding their immediate community. So they're very much limited in their mobility, but also in their education. And for all of the girls, too, their mothers certainly and their fathers have certainly taken a toll during that time as well, either losing jobs and just not finding a basic means for income as well. So you see a lot of the girls who very much have struggled financially and whose families were very much living in terms of poverty, in addition to even just their culturally being limited by being not being able to listen to the radio or watch TV as well. So it was certainly a very difficult time for each of these girls and their families.
Yeah, there's a remarkable scene where one of the girls is going through her mother's things and finds a photograph of her wearing a short skirt, and she just can't even imagine that time.
Yeah, definitely. And that story is also interesting. That's the Freshta and Layla, the sisters. But they did happen to go to Pakistan late in the mid-'80s, late-'80s. And so they have a little bit of a different perspective as well of the country, more of an outsider perspective. And certainly, yes, their mother lived a very different life than what the girls live themselves, which is also a very interesting dynamic. And you have these adult women who know a different Afghanistan and know a different life and have very much had more opportunities than their own daughters had at that time. And so I think for many of these mothers as well, it was a struggle to see their daughters so limited in life and life experiences. So I think certainly after 9/11 and when the Taliban left Kabul, in the sister's case, the family immediately returned to Afghanistan and to some degree maybe expecting the same life that they lived before, which did not happen to be the case at all.
And I suppose that fact that these mothers in particular remembered a different life plays into the fact that the one thing that wasn't as difficult as you might have imagined was getting parents to agree to allow their daughters to travel halfway across the world and participate in this program.
Sure, yeah. You know, I really believe, especially as a result of this work, that parents universally around the world want what's best for their children, whether it's a boy or a girl. And certainly these women and the mothers and the fathers have been champions for their own daughters along every step of the process. And while they, I'm sure, have the typical parent questions of ensuring the safety and the comfort of their daughters while they were in the States, they very much looked at this opportunity as a unique one that, you know, might not come to them later on. And certainly having faced what they have faced over the past 25, 30 years, it was a welcome change and a glimmer of hope to some degree for the families and for the girls.
Can you talk for a minute about, you had some partners on the ground, I know, and one of the things that you did when you were recruiting players for this first trip to the States was, because you didn't know who could play soccer and who couldn't, you looked for leadership qualities.
We did, yes. Certainly also maturity in the girls and making sure that they could handle a trip being a home away from home for 6 weeks. But yes, leadership was also very much at the top of the list. And as I said earlier, the goal was that they would return back as leaders in the community, hoping to spread the sport of soccer to others and just sports in general. And hopefully even also sharing their experience in the States as well. And certainly I think, you know, looking back now 5 years later, the girls that were selected were very strong candidates and very confident and competent leaders who have contributed to a large degree back home to help more girls play the sport as well.
How were they greeted when they were traveling around the country here?
They were greeted very warmly, and really they were like little celebrities that year. And I think people were just so eager and enthusiastic to meet them, and it was such an interesting story. You know, these are Afghan girls soccer team, and that's all you really needed to say in order to get any kind of reaction, and it was always overwhelmingly positive. And certainly also there was just a lot of questions for these girls. You know, what was their life like before? What was it like today? And were they happy with the changes taking place in their country? So we also really couldn't avoid some of these political discussions as well, which was very interesting. And these girls were also at that time very poised to answer it. And, you know, and really were very hopeful and optimistic for the country and also thankful for the changes that had taken place over the course of a few years.
Now, you were raised speaking Pashto at home. They spoke mostly Dari. Can you talk about how you had to communicate with them?
Sure. Yeah, it was interesting. I think you don't really think about the logistics of language until the girls got here for me. And to some degree, it was just so busy thinking of the every day-to-day, getting coaches and equipment that I just didn't really think of how would I really communicate with these girls. And I knew that for the most part, they would all speak Dari. And a few spoke Pashto. So I would communicate with those that spoke Pashto to communicate and translate to the others as well. But we did have an Afghan-American soccer player who was also part of the team who very much served as a translator for me. But what ended up being interesting also was that because they all spoke Dari, that was very much the common language they all turned to, they formed this community, this really strong bond among themselves, and also really had to deal with conflict internally as well. And even though I was there as an adult figure every day of the camp, there were times where I didn't know what was going on, only to find out later on that it had already been resolved internally. And so that was a very interesting thing to end up happening because when they went back, they also learned how to deal with issues internally without always having to go to an adult figure to resolve their issues. So it did really, in the end, help them be a stronger team by default of me not being able to always jump in and communicate and intercede in issues.
How did they seem to you when you first met them? Did the fear and the hardship that they had endured, was that sort of apparent in their demeanor?
Not necessarily. I know they were very shy, but I don't think it's because of that. But it was more also because they were in this brand new environment with people that they were just learning about and coming to know and trust. And that changed pretty quickly once they knew that they could rely on me and trust me, and especially once they met my parents who speak fluent Dari as well. So little by little, their shell did definitely crack open. And I would say more so, not even in their personalities off the field, but it was much more in the personalities on the field where I saw the conflict that, you know, and the impact of war that it had on their personalities in terms of being pushed beyond your limits. And how do you handle it? You know, do you handle it with grace and do you communicate, or do you handle it like they did at times with just arguing and violence right away? So I think that's more where I saw that issue come into play.
How did your parents, by the way, who I'm sure were delighted that you had this wonderful career in chemistry and a degree under your belt, how did they deal with the fact that you wanted to do something totally different with your life?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely struggled with it. My father is an engineer, and my mother was a teacher at the time. And so they're very my father especially is a very practical man. You know, if you have a degree in engineering, you do engineering. You know, if you have a degree in chemistry, you do chemistry. And I think also for them, having raised kids in the States, that's not necessarily the mindset that we have here in America. It's that you can do whatever your heart desires, whether or not you majored in chemistry or engineering or math or history. And so my father very much did struggle with the issue of me not really feeling content anymore with chemistry. And he really did, in the beginning, question my decisions to leave my work as a chemist. And I was working for General Electric, which even more so, you know, was a very prestigious career to have. But I think once the girls got here, I could see my father also changing. And he really became emotional as well in dealing with the girls and talking to them. And I think for him and my mother, they both saw this return of an Afghanistan that they had been yearning to come back to. And while they probably physically couldn't go back, you know, they haven't even been back yet. But they, I think in them, in these girls, saw some hope and really look to a new Afghanistan moving forward.
So what was the plan for when they did return home?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of being young and 23 sometimes, too, is maybe you don't plan all of that out as well. And I learned, you know, I learned the hard way also that I should have had a more concrete plan. But while even I did, while I didn't have one, certainly the girls on their own kind of makeshifted a plan as along the way. And what happened, which has been very interesting, again, looking back 5 years later, is that the Afghan Football Federation locally happened to start a girls' soccer team and a girls' soccer program around the same time these girls went back. And that was simply by coincidence. So by default, the girls, the eight girls who returned, were literally the best soccer players in the country. And they fed into that system very easily. And they were certainly some of the best, you know, for a few years that the country had ever seen. And so while I didn't set that up, certainly locally the system was in place to support these girls. And for many of these girls now, they played on the Afghan national team, which is much more of a grassroots team. But also, even locally, some of these girls have started their own girls' soccer teams and have been very much interested in coaching as well as they become better soccer players over time.
What do they wear to play in Afghanistan?
They do wear more conservative clothing. They don't necessarily wear the shorts and the T-shirts that we'll see more often here in the States. But they'll wear warm-up suits and wear pants and then also shirts that are long sleeve. But if they do wear short sleeves, sometimes it's three-quarter length as well, but it's very loose fitting. But in terms of the headscarf, some girls continue to wear their headscarf, which they do in their everyday lives on the field. And then others have modified it to wear baseball caps as well. And their head is still covered, but for them it's also a little bit more comfortable. So you do see their own personal preference and choice coming into play as well on the field. And certainly while, you know, I think for the average American to hear this, they might react one way or another, you know, I think still they're playing sports and doing so with the freedom to choose that.
So how does it work now in terms of where and when they're allowed to practice?
Yeah, for the most part, you know, the girls are covered, like I said, but also part of the stipulation is they play behind a walled field. And right now there's only two real grass soccer fields, full of regulation size, that are in Kabul. One is the National Stadium, where the girls have played, but another is a military field, which is near ISAF. And Afghanistan, in general, is a very walled culture. You know, you go into backyards, and it's not even a fence, but a brick wall that goes pretty high. But it provides privacy for the women of the family to be out there and to do what they need to do. And that's the same also in terms of soccer, that the Federation was very very direct and honest and open to say that these girls probably aren't. It's not okay for them to play in just any open field in Kabul, but they have to play in one of these two fields. And so the Federation, too, has taken the steps necessary to provide for their security. But, you know, I think, again, I think Americans might react very emotionally towards that decision, but it's the best decision that needs to be made for the girls. And, again, they're still playing. And whether or not it's behind a walled compound or in an open field, I think is not really is beyond the point.
Yeah, there were some issues with them when they were like sort of heading into the fields where they practice and play with catcalls and things like that.
There were, you know, and I think looking back, even in our own struggle with Title IX in the late 70s, I think even female athletes here might have similar stories of just, you know, when you're a woman pushing against the grain and really forcing the culture to reevaluate their stance on something, whether it's soccer or not, there's always going to be some resistance. And so the girls did face that early on. And I think to be expected, you know, whenever you're really changing the culture to that degree. And so they did face issues, but certainly I think today it's lessened over time and is a little bit less severe.
You mentioned the fact that they've played in Ghazi Stadium, the national stadium, and this is a place that under the Taliban was a very, very, had a very different purpose.
It did. It was a grounds for a public execution at the time for those who might have committed acts of adultery or also just other violence that might have overtook the citizens. So it was definitely a place of violence versus that of hope.
And what's wonderful about it being sort of reclaimed now is that this is such a different kind of symbol. Do you think that I mean, I'm guessing it's not lost on the people who go to see these girls play.
Sure, yeah, without a doubt, it's definitely not lost at all. And there's stories, too, in particular, Ariana, where she goes to the stadium for the first time, and those are the first images that she has in her own head when she looks at the field. And it takes her a moment to really move beyond that and to finally even accept that this is a place now where she and other players can play freely on those same fields. And so, certainly it's had a very rough history, but I think looking forward, it's overcome that history as well.
Who comes to watch these games?
When it's the girls, it's mostly just women. It's actually the Federation's very specific that men shouldn't be there, and rightfully so, so that the women themselves have a very safe space where they can feel comfortable playing. And for the men's games, also, it's mostly men who will come out and watch the public games as well. But what's interesting also is, you know, we in the States are very much also conditioned that parents are at every soccer game or every tennis game. And that's not necessarily the case in Afghanistan. Very rarely will you actually see parents who are there just waiting on the sideline and watching their kids play because it's not a priority. They have so many more immediate needs that they have to take care of for their family. And so they don't have that luxury today. So I think that was something interesting, too, for me to see when I first went back to Afghanistan and watched these games.
Yeah. Can you describe the experience of you arriving there for the first time? Because this is after they had come for the 6-week clinic in the States. Mm-hmm. You went back later.
Yeah. I mean, I kept in touch with the girls over the years via phone. And there was always that question of when are you going to come back? And finally, 2 years later, I did. And I have an interesting moment where there was a point where I was flying into Kabul where I was wondering if I really could handle this trip. I was going alone for the most part. I was with another friend of mine, an American friend, but my parents weren't there with me. And certainly while I remember the language and speak Pashto, I was very nervous about my ability to even communicate fluently while I was there and just general apprehensions of the country. So it was certainly an uphill battle of a struggle for me at times as well.
Awista Ayoob is my guest. She's founder of the Afghan Youth Sports Exchange. Her new book is called However Tall the Mountain, A Dream, Eight Girls, and a Journey Home. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Awista Ayoob. She's founder of the Afghan Youth Sports Exchange. Her new book is called However Tall the Mountain, A Dream, Eight Girls, and a Journey Home. Will you talk for a minute about the proverb that forms the basis of your title?
Sure. It's an Afghan saying in full, which is however tall the mountain, there's always a road. And it's very much indicative of the struggles that Afghans have had to overcome, and despite obstacles that they do so.
Do you have the sense now that people, as they gain back certain freedoms and as things are changing, are they sort of afraid to be confident that this will continue? There are still large sections of the country that remain under the thumb of the Taliban.
Yeah, I mean, I think Afghanistan is really at a crossroads today, and certainly where it moves forward from here will really determine the history of the country from this point on. And it's really difficult. You know, you have pockets of progress in the country, but then also areas that are very much struggling and being overtaken by the Taliban and insurgencies and just general insurgent forces as well that are very much undermining efforts that have been done the past 7 years. So it's certainly a very difficult struggle today. And really, I think for some of these Afghans who are living in the more rural villages, it's probably even a confusing struggle of knowing who to support and who to trust as well. And it's not an easy decision for them to come to.
So for a while, you were sending American coaches over to Afghanistan to work with these groups of girls. Can you talk about how that played out?
Sure. I think for me, wanting to maximize on the impact of the work it was a very natural progression to want to go to Afghanistan. And, you know, I really believed in also bringing Afghan-American coaches who were also exiled from the country, like myself. And it was a really unique opportunity for them to not only connect again with the homeland, but to also give back. And it was just a really overwhelmingly positive experience for all of us. And we formed such a strong, tight-knit bond as a result of that trip. And in going back, I think it was just really interesting to see how many girls showed up at our clinics. And we worked directly with the Afghan Football Federation, who at the first trip in 2006 had over 15 girl soccer teams just in Kabul who were participating. So we had over 250 girls, and we gave out equipment as well as health clinics on the basics and the fundamentals of the sport. So we were certainly welcomed very positively, and I think the lasting impact has also been very positive as well. But in 2007, I returned again, and this time we worked with the basketball teams. And, you know, the security and the situation had on the ground had changed so much just in 1 year. And in 2006, after we left, there was a number of series of bombings that took place in Kabul for the first time that May that really changed the landscape of the city from that day forward. And in 2007, when we were there, we drove across several suicide bombing attacks that happened in Kabul. So I think even for us, I think reality started to sink in as well, that this is a war zone, and it's still not as safe and as calm as it used to be.
It's got to be really devastating when you've taken one step up to then have to take at least a step and a half back.
Definitely, and I think that's very much the sentiment by the local Afghans. In doing the research for the book, there was an analogy that was very much often used by all the families, which is that a house built on a faulty foundation will eventually crumble. And the way the Afghans look at their government today is that it's very much faulty, and it's laced with corruption and just dishonesty at all levels, whether it's the local or the national level of government. So I think, you know, to see even that Afghans locally are very much disenchanted by the system is very troubling to hear. And I think they are starting to lose that hope that they really had immediately after the Taliban left in October of 2001. And I think that's very sad to see on the whole, is that, I think many remember the images of Afghans dancing in the streets and cheering joyously back in late 2001, to now see that they're so frustrated that they're not even showing up to the polls to vote. Is a clear sign that things are changing for the worse today.
Mm-hmm. Frustrating, and I know a lot of people are also still frightened.
They are. Again, there's just so much uncertainty as well, and it's hard for the local Afghans to know who to believe and who to support. And it doesn't help also that there's constant violence in their backyard. I think for me as an Afghan-American, I'm very saddened even more so to see the situation deteriorating as quickly as it has. And I think there might be some hope moving forward, but it's really has to come with more clear direction and really an effort to curb the rampant corruption that's really overtaken the government.
So when you first brought the girls over in 2004, they were between 11 and 16. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So obviously, several of them are entering young adulthood now. Can you talk about a little bit about how some of their individual lives have played out that you've been able to follow?
Sure. Some of the girls are actually in the States now studying, which is great. Those whose English is a little bit more stronger than the others. But what's also been interesting is in talking to the girls, when I would ask them about their hopes and their dreams and whether or not marriage was something they wanted, they all said yes, but not now. And for many of them, they are at the marriage age. And for some, their mothers already had possibly a child by the age that they are today. So it's interesting to see that they've all remained unmarried, and they've all really want to pursue their education and jobs opportunities down the road as well. So I think this idea and this notion of personal freedom and personal choice has certainly come back into their lives again, which is certainly very wonderful to hear. But they're all very hopeful and optimistic for their own lives and do want to make a difference in Afghanistan's future.
Well, and it takes a certain kind of courage, even just within their own families. You write about one young woman whose aunt said, well, playing soccer is not going to help you get a husband and get married.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, that's even a line that I think many women who might have struggled with the early phase of Title IX might have even heard here. But yes, I think, you know, they don't see the value in sports. Like I said, families don't show up to the soccer field to support their daughters. So the girls, while they have this choice, I think, at home, still struggle at times with the decisions that they're making in order to play.
Are they mostly still playing?
Most of them are, yes. Some of them are, and two girls in particular that are not written about in more detail in the book don't play. And family issues have come into play with just limiting that option. But for those who do, they're doing so very strongly and doing so with a lot of pride for their country and really hoping to see a national team that's very strong down the road.
How do you feel about the girls who are here studying? Is there part of you that really wants them to go back and share the ways that they've grown? And then is there part of you that wants them to be here where they're safe and have guaranteed opportunities as women?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult question because I struggle with it daily when I think about it. And I know, you know, Afghanistan struggled so long ago in the late 70s with brain drain. You know, so many Afghan refugees left the country. And for the most part, those were the educated Afghans. So as a result, you know, what you're seeing now with some of the setbacks in Reconstruction is also because there's not enough educated and knowledgeable Afghans who are living there locally to really take the reins and move it forward. So in the future, though, I do hope these girls will go back and that they will want to contribute and really take their country forward. And I think that they also want that for themselves. But, you know, only time will tell what the future will hold and if the country will be secure and safe enough to return.
You mentioned that when you went in 2006, you brought equipment with you, and a lot of that was donated. Is that right?
It was, yeah. We received a number of donations from teams and then also the U.S. Soccer Foundation, and they have a U.S. Passback program that also made a donation of over 20 boxes of new and used equipment that year. So certainly, you know, the outpouring of support was very strong and very positive. And anything having to do with Afghanistan, I think it's very easy for the American public to want to also give back, and it was certainly such a unique opportunity and a unique story to give back to.
Awista, aside from the war effort, are there things that you think the international community, whether it's governments or NGOs or private individuals, should be doing that's not taking place right now that might give particularly girls and women in Afghanistan a better leg up?
Sure. I mean, I think in general, and not even just speaking only about women's issues, but there has to be greater accountability in terms of the Afghan government and just the general expectations by the international community for what standards they should hold themselves up to, and also they themselves as international donors. I think sometimes that we haven't held them up to higher and more strict standards, and I think over time, you know, you kind of lose that accountability, and that's certainly played a big role in where the country is today, in my opinion. And so moving forward, I know the current administration is very focused on that, to set benchmarks, but also to make sure that both the Afghan government and then international governments also uphold those benchmarks. And if they don't, that there should be certain, if I can say, repercussions, you know, that maybe there's less aid given the following year or something else. But certainly to just have money that's distributed to a country without accountability is a recipe for disaster and has really led to some of the corruption that we see today.
Yeah, we had a discussion on this program last week about the fact that a great deal of the money that has been set aside for reconstruction aid to Afghanistan ultimately gets spent on and by and with U.S. companies, and not too much of that work actually filters down to the people who need it. Are people in Afghanistan sort of acutely aware of this and disappointed, or are they not really even in a position to criticize given that they've got so many serious problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are in a position to certainly criticize and question it without a doubt, and it's their country. So I think there has to actually be more communication and direct communication to the people. I think they are aware of it, and what happens is that because they're not really viewed as key stakeholders at times within the discussion, not enough is communicated to them. And so instead of just being open and assuming it's for the best, that they are questioning the role of the international community as a result. So I think even more so what the administration can do is to have more open lines of communication with the local Afghans. That, you know, what the local Afghans often hear in the news too is that billions of dollars have been given to the country in aid. And then as a result, when they don't see change in their backyard, of course they're going to question it. Well, where's my portion of the $1 billion? And so I think lines of communication have to be more open and more direct.
Were there things that you finally understood about your parents and their culture after you traveled to the place where they had spent their entire lives until they emigrated?
Without a doubt, yeah. I mean, I think my parents were always very good in general about having the culture be very strong in our home. So in terms of learning new things, I did learn new things, but I think as a young adult, sometimes it's easy, and even as a kid, to wonder why am I having to sit here on a Saturday morning and learn how to read and write in Arabic? And I think as an adult, when I went back, it really affected me even more so to have a greater appreciation for the efforts that both my parents went to make sure that the culture was as strong as it was within our own household.
It's clear that this program has had an impact on the young women who participated and probably also on their sisters and their girlfriends. I wonder if you've also thought about the message that this growth in youth sports for young Afghan women, the message that sends to their brothers.
Sure. I mean, I think it shows them, too, that they're, you know, even more so that the country is heading in a direction that will hopefully have an equal playing field for both. And many times in the stories, you see that the brothers are very supportive. And usually the girls first saw soccer played outside with their brothers playing. And then oftentimes now these girls are playing in those same games in their own backyard. So I think even more so it's really showing these boys that, you know, men and women are working more towards an equal playing field. So it has certainly had a positive impact directly on the families and the young men in those families.
Yeah, there's a nice little vignette about one of the girls seeing the boys kick a soccer ball out of the way, and she thinks to herself, I'll return it in a little while, and then I'll show them how to actually kick it.
Exactly, yeah.
How optimistic are you that the girls that you've come to care about through this project will be able to lead truly liberated lives during the years when they are still young adults?
You know, I'm very hopeful, but there's also this issue of culture, the local culture. And so sometimes my dreams and desires for them might not match the local dreams and desires for them. And so with that, I can't necessarily dictate it for them. But they have to find their own path and go through their own struggle, too, to own their own life decisions. So I think that's just part of the course of life as a whole. But certainly what I have seen is that the girls will stand up and step up for what they believe in and do so with more confidence than they might have had before. You know, and I can't say that with 100% certainty that this program is what did it, but I can certainly say from my own experience with them that I've seen them mature over time to have that confidence, without a doubt.
Is it possible for people to follow what's going on with these teams from a distance? Is there something on the internet that sort of tells you about the games as they're taking place?
No, not per se. I mean, the federations locally now manage all the programs and the teams. So as for their capacity in terms of that, I don't know if they have much. But without a doubt, you can go online and still find a lot of great articles and news stories about the national team and other teams through my own work or other projects in Afghanistan today. But my own website, too, awistayoub.com, has a lot of information about my work there in the past and some of the media stories that have covered these programs.
Awista Ayoub founded the Afghan Youth Sports Exchange in 2003. Her new book is called However Tall the Mountain, A Dream, Eight Girls, and a Journey Home. Awista, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.